Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Well, good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, and glad to be with you because today we're going to hear a story of a man who, has been serving Christ for many years, former senior editor at Christianity Today magazine, which is really the journal of record for American evangelicals. 20 years he was with Christianity Today. This magazine, by the way, started back in the 1950s by Billy Graham and a number of other people. It was intended to become, intended to compete with the mainstream Protestant publications of the period. Christianity Today was known for its emphasis on divine revelation. And, we're now in the third generation since its origin. Mark Galley just came into the full communion with the Catholic Church just after he left Christianity Today magazine. We're going to ask Mark about that story. Also today, we're going to be joined by Matt Smith from Our Sunday Visitors Catholic Innovators Challenge. It's the OSV Challenge. They're giving away three $100,000 grand prizes, and this is merit-based. There's no raffle here. This is all merit-based. We're going to talk to Matt Smith about it. It's a fascinating new project from Our Sunday Visitor. And in the second hour, we're going to listen to a conversation I had with Dr. Paul Kangor just a while ago after the release of his book, The Devil in Karl Marx. Now, this book apparently has incurred the disfavor of people over at Facebook. They're not permitting it to be advertised. And so I thought that controversy and the fact that we're just acknowledging the anniversary of Marx's publication of the Communist Manifesto, it would be a good idea to go back and take a listen to Paul Kangor's story of communism's deadly legacy. But first, let's get to today's headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News. For Wednesday, February 24th, it's the Feast of Blessed Joseph Mayer Neusser. Today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at charitymobile.com. The car crash that injured golf legend Tiger Woods is being called, quote, purely an accident. That update from the Los Angeles County Sheriff saying Woods won't face any charges. The 45-year-old had rod and screws put in his right leg yesterday after rolling his car off a road. A House committee is looking into domestic terrorism after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol.
Former President Trump directed a group of his followers, which included an array of hate-filled extremists, to attack the Capitol and Congress at a time when we were fulfilling our sacred constitutional duty.
Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee says domestic terrorism is on the rise across the U.S., primarily at the hands of violent white nationalist groups. A post-election survey shows a majority of those who voted for President Biden reject many Christian teachings. The survey of nearly 430 Biden voters show while 65% describe themselves as Christian, nearly 60% said are not deeply committed to practicing the religion, with close to 70% saying the Holy Spirit isn't a living entity, but a symbol of God's presence, power, or purity. Just 30% agreed that the Bible is, quote, the actual or inspired word of God and contains no errors, with the same number saying that identifying moral truth is up to each individual, and there are no moral absolutes that apply to everyone. YouTube is letting parents limit what their kids can watch with the new supervised mode. It's a stepping stone from the YouTube Kids app to the full YouTube site. Parents will be able to set up a special account for their tweens and teens with content filters and restrictions. I'm C. Clark, Ave Maria, Radio News.
afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. My guest, Mark Galley, spent 20 years as a managing editor and then editor-in-chief of Christianity Today magazine. It really is the journal of record for American Protestant evangelicals. And he received his Master's of Divinity from Fuller Theological Seminary, served as a Presbyterian pastor for 10 years in Mexico City and Sacramento. He's authored 9 books, including Francis of Assisi and His World, and an introductory biography of Karl Barth, probably the greatest Protestant theologian of the 20th century. Most recently, When Did We Start Forgetting God? The Root of the Evangelical Crisis and Hope for the Future. Mark recently has come into full communion to the Catholic Church, and I thought it might be a good idea just to ask him why. Mark, good to have you here. Thanks.
Hey, good to be with you. An honor to be with you. Thanks, Al.
I should probably tell you that for nearly 20 years, I worked within evangelical Protestantism myself, pastored a church for 5 years, and returned to the Catholic Church in 1992. So there are probably lots of names and people and events that we're both aware of from the evangelical world. Let's talk a little bit about your own upbringing. How were you raised?
Well, I was I wouldn't even say I was raised nominally Catholic, other than the fact that I was baptized as a Catholic and took First Communion as a Catholic. But to be honest, I don't ever remember going to church as a Catholic boy. The only reason I remember First Communion is because of the pictures we have. Mm-hmm. So we weren't a very observant Catholic family. The non-religious family would be the most accurate way of describing it.
Okay.
Until my mother had an evangelical conversion experience when I was in junior high school, that's when religion became a part of my life.
Okay. Did you have a similar experience?
Yeah, I was a young man, and I was wrestling with, the whole biblical picture of what God requires of us, and that was mixed with typical evangelical evangelistic preaching and an altar call at the end of every service.
Yeah.
And I vowed at the end in December that I was just going to go forward so I wouldn't feel guilty every Sunday. I went forward, and son of a gun, if the next Sunday I didn't feel just as guilty.
I know.
I credit God's grace that it didn't make me doubt what I'd done. I knew that I'd made a decision to follow Christ, and regardless of what was going on inside me, I had to figure out what was going on inside me. But for some reason, even though that negative experience and then all the ups and downs through adolescence, never occurred to me to abandon the faith, and I credit that completely to God's grace.
Yeah. Did you find any support groups at the time that, young people's groups or the church have a good youth ministry?
I had a very good youth ministry at the First Presbyterian Church of Santa Cruz.
Okay.
During my college years, I determined I was going to become, I felt called to become a pastor.
Okay.
So I did youth ministry myself in my, between college and seminary. As you know, coming out of the evangelical world, youth ministry is a huge cog in the wheel of
yes.
how Christians are formed
yep.
in the evangelical world. So it's very formative.
No, and that's true. And actually, that's one thing that I think Catholic parishes might take some cues from, because often there are not strong youth ministries within Catholic circles.
No, in fact, when I was a pastor in Mexico City, I was the youth pastor, and the Catholic priest. So we were part of the English-speaking community, but the Catholic priest of the English-speaking Catholic Church sent his kids over to us because
yeah.
he knew his church couldn't offer it, and he knew I was ecumenical enough not to cram a
right.
certain type of Christianity down their throats.
Sure.
And, I agree that Protestant evangelicals do youth ministry really well.
Yeah. I mean, it's in some ways, it's pragmatic, it's inventive, it's creative, and part of it's entrepreneurial. I mean, that's, that has its strengths
Definitely,
and its weaknesses.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Right.
Yeah,
and it's also it hooks into the emotions that youth feel.
Yeah,
I think the Catholic Catechism is actually a very requires a certain level of intellectual and emotional maturity to really understand what's going on.
Right.
And evangelical youth ministries, they bring things down to very simple propositions and very simple teachings that a young person can engage with. So, you know, I'm sure you have known it, and I've known both Orthodox young men and Catholic young men who, in a sense, have some sort of conversion experience or spiritual experience in an evangelical youth group. They eventually end up returning to Orthodoxy or Catholicism. But, you know, evangelicalism gives them something that a lot of Catholic youth groups aren't able to provide.
No, I agree with you. So when you you began, did you go to seminary right after college?
I took 1 year off and did youth ministry at a Presbyterian church in Fresno, California.
Okay. And then did you go to Fuller then?
Yeah, I went to Fuller Seminary.
Good. And how was your experience there?
It was good. It was intellectually rigorous. That was my criticism as I left, was that I was prepared to exegete in Greek and Hebrew. I didn't know if I was very good. I didn't know if I was trained to be able to conduct a funeral or a baptism. But it did hook into me my lifelong passion for things theological, and stirred me up in that way. And that's never left me, my interest in theology and my... So I've just read a ton of theology. In fact, I'd read so much theology, including Catholic theology, that when I applied to go to the RCIA class at the local, at my St. Mike's here in Wheaton, after interviewing me, both the priest and the head of the class said, "No, you don't need to go. You know way more than anybody in this class." Yeah. But they did still recommended a couple books, and I did vow to finish the catechism.
Sure.
I didn't quite finish it, but I'm still working my way through.
Yeah, it's a rich feast, and it takes a while.
It's an amazing document. It is absolutely stunning, and it's both clarity and depth. It's a stunning piece of work.
No, I agree. Were you, as an evangelical, what did you think about the competing visions and versions of Christianity? Did that bother you? If not, when did it begin bothering you?
Yeah, I don't know when it began bothering me, but I know sometime during my stint, the first job I took at the company Christianity Today, the ministry Christianity Today, was a magazine called Leadership. It was for pastors.
I remember that.
Then I worked for a magazine called Christian History, and that's when it began. It became clear and clear how, unfortunately, divisive Protestantism had become. In fact, I wrote an article about it at the time, and I remember doing the research and finding out there were something like 20,000, 25,000 Protestant denominations at the time. And then I read about that stat about 10 years later, and it had grown by 5 or 10,000. It was just, it was so, that's so discouraging when, and for whatever reason, probably the prompting of the Holy Spirit, Paul's letters are full of pleas for unity, and then there's Jesus' high priestly prayer, which is, you know, as an evangelical, I wanted to share the faith of Christianity. I wanted to share Jesus Christ with other people, his reality of his death and resurrection. And Jesus himself says, you know, they're going to know you are my followers if you're one.
Right. Yeah. He gives the world the right to judge.
Yeah, so it's like evangelicalism, greatest passion is to win people to Christ, but it lives a lifestyle that's a tremendous detriment to that in the sense that it's so divisive.
Yeah.
The joke is if there's two Baptists in a room and they have a disagreement, they start three churches. It divides so quickly.
Is that uniquely American, or is that true among evangelicals in other countries?
Oh, I think that's true worldwide.
That's
true, especially the places where it's exploding.
Yeah.
I mean, evangelicals rightly take some pride in the amount of evangelical growth in, like, Africa and China.
Right.
But if you dig a little deeper, what you find is, there are a lot of solid Orthodox evangelical congregations and denominations, but there's a lot of heresy and schismatics and cults also all going on at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it's a crazy amalgam of stuff that's going on.
So you really kind of rose within the evangelical subculture, being managing editor of Christianity Today, and then executive editor, I guess it was, or chief, I can't remember what it was,
editor-in-chief.
Editor-in-chief, that's right. When you began working, I mean, you weren't trained as a journalist. That's something you kind of grew into, I take it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I had started writing as an avocation when I was a pastor in Mexico City, and then I began trying to get published by various Christian publications, and I eventually figured out how to do that and how to write well, how to write to a specific audience. Mm-hmm. And then the editor at Leadership saw some potential in me, and he invited me to come on staff. I thought I'd do it for 2 or 3 years, but apparently I took to it like a fish takes the water. I just knew how to do it. I mean, I needed training, obviously, but it did seem to be a very good fit for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I certainly have enjoyed your work over the years. I should say that, too.
Thank you.
Aware of your work, yeah. So when do you begin to think that you may need to, that the Holy Spirit may be leading you into some larger affiliation, either Orthodoxy, perhaps, or Catholicism, or even Anglo-Catholicism.
Yeah.
People often go that way.
Well, I had hints of it all through my, probably starting in my ministry in Sacramento, just little, vague little hints. But probably the one key moment that I remember distinctly was when I was editor of Christian History, and I was It was a thematic publication, and I was editing an issue on Francis of Assisi. I was so impressed with his life and his devotion and his radical obedience to Christ in poverty. And in the evenings, because, as I said, I have theological interest, I was trying to keep up with the writings of the day, and I was reading John Paul II, A Veritatis Splendor, The Splendor of Truth.
Yeah.
In the evenings, before I went to, as I went to bed, and I was just amazed at the profundity of his mind and the profundity of Francis's life. Church, my gosh, produced both these great men in some sense at opposite ends of the personality.
Right, right.
And that took my interest.
Great. Hold it there, Mark. We'll be right back.
There are lots of great ways to connect with us at AveMariaRadio.net, like our poll of the week. This week we want to know, what are some things that you are doing for Lent? Let us know now at AveMariaRadio.net and stay tuned to Ave Maria Radio to hear our results for the poll of the week.
The EWTN home video highlight for February is Lourdes with the Franciscan Missionaries of the Eternal Word. Go on pilgrimage with Father Joseph Mary Wolfe and Father John Paul Mary Zeller to the healing waters of Lourdes, where St. Bernadette first encountered Our Lady and where all are now called to conversion. Order your DVD set at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
How important was unity to Jesus Christ? Very, according to the Catholic Catechism. He bestowed unity on his church at the outset. It is something the church can never lose, but with prayer and work, she can improve. This is why, the Catholic Catechism says, Jesus himself prayed at the hour of his passion and continues praying, that they may all be one. As you, Father, are in me, and I in you, may they also be one in us. The Catechism further states, the desire to recover the unity of all Christians is a gift of Christ and a call of the Holy Spirit. The Catechism says there are certain things required in order to respond adequately to this call. A permanent renewal of the church, conversion of the heart, prayer in common, fraternal knowledge of each other, ecumenical formation, dialogue among theologians and Christians, collaboration in good works. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Catholics and the U.S. bishops adjusting to a new administration and the obstacles to the Church's mission of religious liberty in communist China. To learn more about these issues affecting the Church and our faith, keep listening to EWTN Radio and the Ave Maria Radio app.
Why do we need Catholic radio? Because not everybody is sitting in front of a computer or watching their television set at home. How about when driving to work? Catholic radio is there for you. I may be a Catholic priest, but I'm still a student of the faith. And Catholic radio helps supply good material, whether it be a question and answer format show, whether it be a show itself on doctrine or theology. I myself, as a priest, am always learning.
Father Wade thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
How can we have faith and be transformed by the gospel? What part can we play in recreating the world for God's good plan? Once we understand that the gospel is not merely good news, but explosive, life-changing news, our life will never be the same. In Father John Ricardo's new book, Rescued, The Unexpected and Extraordinary News of the Gospel, he helps us to see the world through the lenses of God, with a clear vision of the plot and the outcome of the story that we're living through. You can get Rescued and Father John's other great books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
Crest in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With me is Mark Galley. Mark, for 20 years, served as managing editor and then editor-in-chief of Christianity Today, and recently came into full communion in the Catholic Church. So you're working on Francis of Assisi, you're reading John Paul II, you're amazed at how one community contains both type of men, very, very different, I agree with you. Does that spur you to do something else? Or do you just note that as kind of remarkable?
Well, I think it was the beginning of the stirrings of a recognition of the unrest within me. Mm-hmm. And I tried various ways to deal with that unrest. I explored essentially Catholic mysticism, but mysticism in general.
Mm-hmm.
And found that I wouldn't have time to go into detail of what happened with that, but obviously, there's something really true and right and good about that, but it kind of came to a dead end. The experiential part of it is it's hard sometimes to recognize when God is doing something in you and when you're sort of manipulating yourself through your prayer practice.
Right.
So that was kind of a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of reading in Orthodoxy. I find Orthodox theology, especially its emphasis on the transcendence of God and the mystery of God, just quite fascinating.
Yes.
I attended an Orthodox church for a while. Mm-hmm. I just loved the liturgy. It was fantastic. Anyway, I was exploring. I just knew that there was something deeper, broader than evangelicalism could give me.
Yeah.
Which is, it's just not geared for that sort of thing. It does a couple things really, really, really well, but it doesn't have that breadth and the depth that I think is necessary for a human being to fully flourish in Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So. And then eventually, Orthodoxy turned out to be a dead end for various reasons. And then at that point, it was Roman Catholicism. I think I'd gotten to the conclusion I wanted to be connected, organically connected to a church that went back to the beginning. That was very important
right.
to me for some reason.
Mm-hmm. You wanted that historical continuity as well as the evangelical continuity.
Yeah. And I felt, too, to be honest, I am enthusiastic about ecumenical conversations, but, you know, after reading what what the Catholic, especially what the Catholic Church that came to in an accord with the Lutherans back in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't think that I couldn't think of a really, really good reason to stay separate, because even though there are still some differences,
yes,
they're not that big of a deal. Lutherans have come a certain way, Catholics have come a certain way,
mm-hmm.
and it struck me that I could sit outside the church and long for unity, or I could just say it's time to become part of that unity.
Right,
and that's sort of that was an important moment in my thought.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, yeah. That's similar to me. I was wondering what reason did I have for my separate ecclesiastical existence? We had an independent church, and I was bemoaning the loss of unity in the church. And I began finally to say, well, how do I fly my flag on this thing? Do I go join something bigger? Eventually, it led me back to the Catholic faith. Were there any particular authors that were helpful to you along the way? And you're obviously a reader and a writer. Are there any standouts, though?
Probably the standouts in terms of thinking about the church more as an organic whole and as a mystery and as a body in which Christ is present sacramentally in all sorts of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to say that probably the most influential writings were initially Orthodox writers. Alexander Schmemann.
Yeah, I love him.
The book of the Life of the World.
Yep, love that book.
Also has a book on the Eucharist, which is really powerful.
Right.
So John Paul II, some of his stuff, What I Can Penetrate, in his Theology of the Body, which is impenetrable, I've appreciated deeply.
Yeah.
But I will say on a more popular level, I did read Bishop Robert Barron's book on Catholicism, Once But Twice.
Sure.
And I read it audibly.
Yeah.
And I think the second time I read it, I read it in the car while I'm working out at the gym. I'm driving in the car and I'm coming to the last chapter in which he's used key Catholic figures all through the book to illustrate various dimensions of Catholicism. Teresa of Avila, Dorothy Day, and Thomas Aquinas, etc. And then at the end of the book, he pulls all these together and to talk about how each of them helped reveal something about God, and they were all part of the Catholic Church. And I was so moved. I was starting to cry. I had to pull over at the side of the road because I couldn't see straight. I didn't feel it was a very good idea to kill someone while I was emotionally converting to Catholicism. But it was that Catholicity again that really deeply impressed me.
Yeah,
this notion of the universal church with all its variety of gifts, variety of passions, variety of viewpoints, but still all willing to live under the same organic umbrella.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not naive enough to believe that there's no huge discussions and disagreements in the Catholic Church.
Right.
Of course there are.
Sure.
But we still basically, when push comes to shove, we all say, yeah, but we're Catholic.
Right, right. That's right. Yeah, the fights are all under the same tent. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And that's a huge, some people say, well, it's just Protestants by another name. And I say, no way. That's
right.
Just so different.
Yeah. Yeah.
That mindset, that's a shift in, it's a gestalt shift in how you think about the world and how you think about the church.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Did you have any particular difficulties in accepting the range of Catholic, you know, doctrine and dogma? Any particular tough areas?
Well, not really, because I think that's one of the things that I think and some of my Protestant friends say, well, I could become a Catholic except for the Immaculate Conception.
Right.
Or I could become a Catholic except for this or that or the other thing. And what they're doing is they're trying to convince themselves to become a Catholic by what you might call a Protestant epistemology.
Yeah.
I need to line up my mental and emotional beliefs. When they line up with this institution, then I can become a part of it.
Yeah.
Instead of saying there's something true, right, and beautiful about this institution, and I just need to come under it and become a part of something bigger than myself.
Yeah.
So when I run across a doctrine like Immaculate Conception is a good one because it's so foreign to Protestants.
Right.
I go, that's rare. That's weird. That's really out of the box. What's going on with that? And instead of saying, how can I force myself to believe it, or now I have to submit in some sort of abject way to believe it, I basically start reading and find out, okay, why do Catholics think this?
Right.
What they're not stupid. There's deep and powerful theologians who defend it. So what's going on? What's the logic there? What are they thinking about? And the thing I've been amazed at, especially when a Protestant might say, well, it's not biblical. I find that some of the doctrines that don't seem to have a biblical basis, in other words, you don't have a text verse, a proof verse,
mm-hmm.
to support them, they're deeply biblical in another way.
Yeah. Yeah.
They seem to be saturated with kind of a biblical ambiance.
Yeah.
That is amazing to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I will not say that I'm, 120% on board with everything I'm being taught, but I am 120% in trying to understand why Catholics think it and believe it and make it a part of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you have any institutional difficulties coming in?
No.
Priests or, no, that's good.
No, I mean, because I was a part of the Presbyterian Church, which was deeply fractious, and the Episcopal Church, which was not only fractious, but there were bishops who were outright heretical, and then there was sexual malfeasance.
Yeah.
I will say it was the week I decided mentally to really push forward on this was the week that the Pennsylvania report on the sex abuse of priests in that diocese came out.
Mercy.
It did give me a jarring moment, but then I know. I've been in the church enough to know it's full of sinners.
Yeah.
And that's just the thing I appreciate about the Catholic Church is that once it was made known, like I've been so impressed with the procedures in my own diocese, the Diocese of Joliet, and the statements of the bishop that came out right after that and how they are serious about dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
I was so gratified that they were taking it seriously.
You know, there's something funny in Catholicism. There's a very high, exalted view of sanctity and holiness, and yet it's an incredibly tolerant place. I mean, it puts up with people who, are lax, nominal Catholics come, and it's just kind of funny. On the one hand, you have this drive towards, again, sanctity, full conformity to Christ. But you also have a community that, if you want to come and hang around and just kind of soak it up a little bit, you can. But
that's very impressive. It's like the difference between Graham Greene, the whiskey priest, his novel The Power and the Glory.
Right.
He's an alcoholic. He's been he's committed sexual sins. He's had a child out of wedlock. And yet he's still plugging along, knowing that his duty as a priest to offer the Eucharist to persecuted Catholics in Mexico. And he does so courageously. So he's, on the one hand, that's God can use anyone at any time to get his work done. And then you've got people like St. Francis of Assisi and other great saints. And I think going into the confessional is... I have that experience every time I go into the confessional, because on the one hand, the tone of the confessionals that I've been going to, it's been, you're here because God is a merciful God.
Yeah. Did you find confession difficult as a, awkward as a Protestant for so many years?
Well, I will say I did remember kind of the opening. I honestly don't know what the typical opening now is, but I guess I was catechized enough to know that I was to enter it and say, bless me, Father, for I have sinned.
Right.
It's been so many days since I knew to say that.
Uh-huh.
And I will say the first confession, my priest agreed because I'd taken First Communion that and before my confirmation, he said he would give me permission to take communion while I was preparing for a confirmation if I did a full confession. And I prepared for that and it was very tearful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm even having a hard time speaking of it now. It was very powerful, though.
Yeah. Beautiful.
But I don't find it awkward at all, except a typical human awkwardness of having to come to my same priest and say, okay, remember that thing I confessed last time? I'm still struggling with it.
Right.
It hasn't gone away.
Yeah. 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 That's
really awkward, but really good discipline. Really good.
Mark, are we going to see you write a book about your experience?
Yeah. I mean, as a Protestant... teacher. I have a small following, the faithful following, 5,000 to 10,000 people who read my books, read my columns.
Yeah.
Most of them are Protestants, and I felt I owe them an explanation.
Yeah. Very good.
Why I've done this.
Okay.
And that's what's going to happen.
We'll talk again soon, Mark. Thank you so much.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. If you're facing uncertainty with your current healthcare plan, now is the time to join CMF Curo. You can join any time during the year, and CMF Curo offers flexible Catholic healthcare solutions for individuals, families, and employers. CMF Curo is your personal healthcare advocate. Contact them today at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
60 Seconds with Father Mitch Pacwa.
The state has responsibility to orient things, but they can't take over the rights of the family, like in China, to have one child and that's it. It's a disaster over there. How many tens of millions of abortions have gone on? And one of the things that, as a result of that, is because of the preference to have boy children rather than girls, you have, for every 1,000 boys, there are 850 girls. This is a great imbalance. Same thing is going on in northern India. So this is where the government cannot take away the primary and inalienable responsibility of married couples and families. And they cannot employ methods which fail to respect the person and fundamental human rights. Beginning with the right to life, the government cannot force you to kill innocent human beings and still be a humanistic government. It's an evil government.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
You as a parent apply Galatians 5. Is watch your kids as they move into the religious space, if you want to put it that way. I, you know, made noises about the priesthood on and off when I was a little kid. My parents were never oppressive about it. They never pressed me in that direction. But they would quietly indicate an openness to that, or like, that's a good thing. I remember I still have it upstairs, a Bible that my parents got me for Christmas in 1969. I'm a little kid. And it's, you know, from Mom and Dad to Bob, Christmas 1969. They knew, they sensed I was kind of interested in religious things. So I would say that, don't be pushy, of course, but don't go the other direction. That's, my generation got too much of that, was, back off. Who am I to tell you what to do? You make up your mind. No, I think gently, quietly, affirming that, yeah, that's a good thing you're thinking about. And you should be open to that.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
When their teens are struggling with depression, parents often wonder whether medication or therapy is the best way to help their kids heal. A new study published in the medical journal The Lancet sheds some light on this question. In a randomized, placebo-controlled, double-blind study, the so-called gold standard in medical research, doctors found that psychotherapy alone helped depressed teens and young adults just as much as those receiving counseling and medication combined. The authors of the study suggest that psychotherapy, especially cognitive behavior therapy, which addresses unhealthy thinking patterns, should be the first line of treatment for teens and young adults, with antidepressants being used only as a support to therapy when necessary. The good news is that teen depression responds tremendously well to treatment, but it's important to make sure that your kids get the right kind of help. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. The OSV Institute for Catholic Innovation has announced the 2021 OSV Challenge, and we're looking at a remarkable project which will eventually offer three $100,000 awards to Catholic innovators. We're going to find out more about this with Matt Smith. Matt's the Director of Strategic Alliances for the OSV Institute for Catholic Innovation. He's responsible for managing their existing relationships while generating
new opportunities and with other Catholic institutions. And Matt, it's good to have you with me.
Thanks so much, Al. I appreciate being here this afternoon.
Well, tell me, first of all, for the listeners who are unfamiliar with the OSV, Institute for Catholic Innovation, what is it? When did it start? A lot of people, of course, know our Sunday visitor, the publisher, and some may even be aware of the Institute. But tell us a little bit about this Institute for Catholic Innovation.
Well, Al, the Institute's been around for a while, since 1915. Archbishop Knoll founded OSV in 1912, and then the Institute is the granting arm of OSV. Archbishop Knoll always felt that whatever funds were generated by OSV should go back to the church, and so that's what we've done.
Yes.
In January 2021, we rebranded the Institute as the Institute for Catholic Innovation, because over the last few years, we've been looking at the impact of our grants. We offered our first challenge last year in 2020, and through some of our analysis, we really felt like the impact that we could have for the Catholic Church was around the idea of innovation through the magisterium, in the magisterium, but really sparking new ideas for the church. And it really goes back to the idea that the Catholic Church has always been about innovation with hospitals, with schools, a number of scientific innovations. And so we really wanted to spark that across the church in North America.
I noticed that you've said you're not just interested in funding projects, but you want to invest in people. Tell me a little bit about that angle.
That's a great question, Al. And part of our application process, while we're very interested in the idea, of course, but we're also interested in the person as an innovator, as an entrepreneur. And so we're really looking, as we do some of the discernment process through questions and interviews and things like that, looking for people that are coachable, are learners. They want to continually learn and also have grit. I think, Al, you probably know and from your experiences that you can't be afraid to fail, and that
right. You
just pick yourself up and you keep going. And so we're really trying to discern that real tribe of innovators and entrepreneurs in the Catholic Church, because, you know, with all those ideas and our challengers from last year exemplified this, there are going to be lots of challenges in that, and you can't be afraid.
What were some of the fruits of last year's challenge?
Well, we had our three winners, and if people want to go to the osvchallenge.com, you can learn more about the challenge this year, but also see our winners last year. And so, you know, a number of the fruits of our winners, we had 12 finalists, and they range from technology ideas all the way to domestic church programming with a podcast network in between and lots of different things. And so now what we're seeing with the three finalists especially, but also with the other nine finalists, is those ideas are increasing in scale and sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, as any granting agency in terms of doing sort of innovation projects like this, we know in 5 years, maybe not all of these entities will be around.
Right.
We hope they all are, of course. But what we're seeing is we provided some catalysts, some spark, not only through capital, but we also provided these organizations with a accelerator course and with mentors and with basically a community. I think a lot of folks out there realize that when you're working on your idea or starting your business or however that goes, it can be a really lonely process. And so one of the fruits of that, just to be honest, Al, is the community that we established.
Mm-hmm.
Those 12
mm-hmm.
finalists are still supporting each other, pointing out, you know, opportunities for their fellow finalists. Maybe this foundation or maybe this funder or maybe this technology doesn't work for me, but maybe it might work for you. So really that fostering of community has been a really powerful fruit for us. And that's something that we really want to keep fostering through the years of this innovation challenge, is build that innovator tribe.
Yeah, that makes sense. It described the process for me. People are, you know, ideas are sparking. What do they do to participate in this community of innovators that you're developing?
Well, the first thing is to go to osvchallenge.com. That is where the application is, but there's a host of information, FAQ page, timeline, sort of what is expected at each stage. And so what we really ask people to do is to think about their ideas. We're really looking for those large, big ideas and start going through the application and start discerning. And we're also here with any questions. There's a number of places that you can submit questions, contact us, because what we found a lot of times, too, is, and we've had people, one of our finalists last year, literally it was sort of a back-of-the-napkin idea, and she contacted us and really just needed that affirmation, go ahead and take a chance. Don't be afraid, apply. And she made it to the finals. And so, you know, really what we ask people, go take a look at the website. We also have a number of our finalists from last year share their stories through short videos on that website. And that might help people, again, just give them affirmation. Don't be afraid. Take that idea. Take that leap of faith.
And are there areas of special interest that the OSV, Institute for Catholic Innovation, has, particular areas that you want to develop and people should be aware of?
Again, that's a great question. But we are really looking for ideas across the spectrum from our artistic endeavors, business ventures, ministry models, physical products, community and charitable initiatives. We're really looking for those big ideas that really can transform the church, that can bring more people to Christ. I mean, that's what we're really trying to be a catalyst for in the end.
This, I mean, it sounds fantastic, and you've already done it last year, so there's every reason to believe this is going to be a very fruitful year, maybe even more so, because as you develop this, you're probably revising every year because you want it to be better and more effective. What would you like to see when this is over? You will have granted the awards. Those are substantial awards. What would you like to see as a result of this next year?
You know, I think a number of, as we've talked about internally at the Institute, we would really like to see, one, we want to see, you know, we want to see ideas that are being actualized that will have an impact on the church. Again, bringing more people to church. As you know, Al, you know, all the data says people are leaving the church, you know, at alarming rates across the spectrum of ages and demographics. And so we really want to, I echo the words of our president, really want to go on the offensive. We want to show people the truth and beauty. We also want to foster that idea of a community of innovation and to reclaim that legacy of innovation for the Catholic Church, you know, not at the expense of anyone else, but
right,
really to show the way and to be a light in this world. Again, because we always think that that's the best way to bring people to the church is really through our outside actions. So really around those ideas of bringing people to the church and a community of innovators to bear fruit across the sustainable time.
And can you describe some of the projects last year that really arrested the attention of your evaluators?
Sure. Be happy to do that. You know, our three finalists sort of span the spectrum. So we had the Domestic Church Project, which was a six-week in-home experience to help parents set up and live the domestic church, which, you know, when we started this Challenge 2020, COVID was not in full swing, but as it became evident, you know, this was a very timely project. We also, one of our winners was Eden Invitation, which is a movement for young adult Catholics experiencing same-sex desires and gender discordance mm-hmm. to thrive as disciples within the church. And so, you know, a very timely project again, too, for many of our millennials, you know, dealing with issues of sexuality, learning about the teachings of the church within a safe environment. And then our final winner was the Juan Diego Network, which is a network that creates, produces groups and distributes audio programs for Latino Catholics to help evangelize, train, and pray and inspire different segments and niches of Latinos around the world. And so, again, not through any sort of strategic thought, but, you know, these three winners sort of hit, you know, areas of the church that we thought really needed that,
sure,
that spark of innovation, that domestic church, the millennials, and then our growing Latino population.
Yep, yep.
So those are three of our winners. But even within the challengers, we had technology. We had a couple technology initiatives. We had Harbor House, which is utilizing church buildings that may not be in use to provide discernment houses for millennials.
Interesting. Tell me about the calendar here. Applications have opened already. Is that right?
That's right. They opened in early February. First round, they have until April 2nd, not April 1st, not April Fool's Day, but April 2nd to apply.
And the contact information is?
OSVchallenge.com. That's where you can find all the information. And if people have specific questions, there are a number of places where they can contact me.
Okay. OSVchallenge.com. Matt Smith's been my guest. He's director of Strategic Alliances for the OSV Institute for Catholic Innovation. And Matt, we'll be talking again. This was great. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. And I do hope you follow up. We'd love to sort of update your listeners on who we're selecting and who's going forward.
Yep, we'll do it. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Again, OSV, our Sunday visitor, has announced this 2021 OSV Challenge for Catholic Innovation, and we'll be keeping our eyes on it. I'm Al Kresta.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
Here's the new challenge. At least 1 hour a week in front of the Blessed Sacrament with the goal of an hour a day in front of the Blessed Sacrament. I had a guy come up to me and he says, Father, you know, I'm doing a lot of things. I'm in a men's fellowship. I pray with my wife every day. I go to Mass every Sunday and usually a couple times during the week. I read scripture. He goes, I want more. I said, do you pray in front of the Blessed Sacrament? He said, outside of Mass, no. I said, I think that's the more. See, all these saints, these are the ones who surround us. These are the ones who ran before us. These are the ones who fought well, who kept the faith. They would tell you, as would every single saint in heaven right now, you cannot run this race if you don't spend time with the Master. Whatever else we're doing, it's second, third, and fourth. First things need to be first. And the first thing is to be with the Master, and the Master is Jesus.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What's looking back at you at age 22? What do you hope to say about that child at age 22? If you're content to say, well, the way kids are turning out nowadays, counting my blessings. Parole officer says one of the nicest children he has. Or would you rather say he's 1 in 100? Morals, compassion, seeks God. Are you prepared to be a 1 in 100 parent then? You can't parent like the bulk of parents anymore. You will supervise far higher. You will screen out toxic media sewage at a rate unlike all of your friends, perhaps your family. No guarantees as to what will be looking back at you at age 22. But you want to be able to say, I think he's 1 in 100. Then you be a 1 in 100 parent.
Connect with us on Facebook. Just search for Kresta in the Afternoon.
Well, thank you for being with me today. Matt Smith, by the way, is Director of Strategic Alliances for the OSV Institute for Catholic Innovation. You can follow up at osvchallenge.com. We'll be talking a little bit more about this project as it develops, but I do think this is an opportunity, again, to look at what creative Catholics are thinking around the country, and we'll keep you abreast of how what the finalists are doing and who the winners eventually are. I do want to take a moment, though, and say that I had a wonderful time this morning doing a video of for Teresa Tomeo's new book, Listening for God. And it was about how in my own experience, I've discerned God's guidance. And I really loved it because I had the chance not only to teach a little bit from Scripture, but also to demonstrate, in particular life experiences, how that biblical teaching played out. And we'll have more on this because Teresa has a one of these big seminars coming up that are going to be handled on Zoom. I'll make you aware of that when we get all the date and information. But I wanted to tell you ahead of time, I think it's going to shape up. It's shaping up to be an outstanding seminar, even if it is, on Zoom. Well, going on next hour, we've got Dr. Paul Kengor. This is an interview I recorded a few months ago. But it came to mind because of the anniversary of the publication of the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx back in, I think it was 1848. And then we had the strange story of Facebook refusing to take advertising for the book, The Devil and Karl Marx, which is Paul Kengor's recent book. This is really remarkable. Many of us remember very clearly when the Berlin Wall fell. I know it was a while ago, 1989, but it was seen as a victory for the entire Western world. You might say that democratic capitalism had, demonstrated victory over socialist, communistic Soviet Union. So many people have forgotten what an achievement that was. We're going to talk it over with Paul coming up next hour. I'm Al Kreskin.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Well, good afternoon. Good to be with you for another hour. We're going to spend time with Dr. Paul Kengor. Paul's been with us quite a bit over the years. And this is a conversation I had with him a few months ago regarding his most recent book, The Devil and Karl Marx. It's a good book. It's well-written, well-researched. He's professor of political science at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. He's also the senior academic fellow at the Center for Vision and Values. He's author of over a dozen books, including A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and The Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. Also, he did The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism. But I thought two things led me to want to share this interview with you again. One of them is the anniversary of the Communist Manifesto being published. That was Marx's political pamphlet. It wasn't his big theoretical work, but it was basically a tract, a political tract for the times. It's had an enormous impact since its publication in 1848. And Paul takes a look not only at Marx's work, but looks at its influence today. So many people have forgotten that the West won. There was something called the Cold War, and it had an ending, had a beginning, and it had an ending. And when it was over, the world of democratic capitalism, the world of Christian influence, rolled back the advances of Soviet-style communism. The problem is, Facebook won't even allow Paul Kengor to advertise his book, The Devil and Karl Marx. Now, this is one of those situations, again, where you find persecution. No, I won't go that far. You find harassment. And we're going to have lots of harassment. Persecution may well be down the road. Right now, though, we're seeing more and more incidents of this sort. So I want you to hear. I want you to hear the book. I want you to see its value. And I want you to think about why an organization like Facebook would do what they did in trying to muzzle advertising for the book. But before we go anywhere else, let's go to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, February 24th. It's the Feast of Blessed Joseph Mayor Nusser. Today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at CharityMobile.com. A third coronavirus vaccine is getting the thumbs up from the staff at the FDA. They say Johnson & Johnson's single dose is 72% effective and prevents 100% of hospitalizations and deaths. A committee could give approval as soon as Saturday, with 3 to 4 million doses to be delivered within days. Minneapolis officials say they will start fortifying the city in the coming days to prepare for the start of the trial of the former police officer accused of killing George Floyd. Police Deputy Chief Eric Forrest tells residents what to expect.
But it's going to be a highly visible presence of officers paired with National Guard soldiers, providing patrol and presence and deterrence, really, in key business corridors.
Jury selection begins in Derek Chauvin's trial March 8th. The White House says President Biden is seeking to recalibrate the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia.
The president is taking a fresh approach to how he engages with foreign leaders around the world, and different from the prior administration.
Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the president will speak with Saudi King Salman at the appropriate time. Biden's upcoming meeting with the Saudi king comes before the scheduled release of a U.S. intelligence report detailing the murder of prominent journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is proposing a new bill to combat the Chinese government's influence on the U.S. economy.
The new legislation must achieve three goals. One, boost American competitiveness by investing in our economy and our workers. Two, leverage our alliances abroad. And three, stop once and for all China's predatory practices.
The New York Democrat says for decades, China has sunk American jobs because of unfair competition and the manipulation of currency. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Before Christ's second coming, the church must pass through a final trial that will shake the faith of many believers. I'm reading from the Catechism 675 here. The persecution that accompanies her pilgrimage on earth will unveil the mystery of iniquity in the form of a religious deception, offering men an apparent solution to their problems at the price of apostasy, or departure, or falling away from the truth. The supreme religious deception is that of the Antichrist, a pseudo-messianism by which man glorifies himself in place of God and of his Messiah come in the flesh. The Catechism doesn't leave it there. It says, the Antichrist's deception already begins to take shape in the world. Every time the claim is made to realize within history that messianic hope, which can only be realized beyond history, that's with Christ's return, okay? And then it says, the church has rejected even modified forms of this falsification of the kingdom to come, under the name of millenarianism, especially the intrinsically perverse political form of a secular messianism. I bring this up because occasionally you'll hear people say that, well, maybe more often than occasional, you'll hear people say, well, faith has nothing to do with politics. Usually they say that because they're frustrated by one thing or another. But in fact, Catechism of the Catholic Church warns that within history there will be political forces that will attempt to blow the trumpet for a new order of things. Okay, this is the attempt to realize in history that kingdom, that era of perfection, that era of global harmony, and perfect justice and perfect love, which we should strive for,
but we should never anticipate it before the return of Christ. In fact, those who are trying to make it happen in history always end up having to use coercion to get people to do it according to their plan. That's the major difference here between those false kingdoms. They rely on coercion. We've seen it time and again in various forms of communism and socialism. Now, that's a long introduction to what is going to be, I think, an outstanding interview today. The Devil and Karl Marx. It's Dr. Paul Kengor's newest book. And you know Paul. He's with us frequently here. He's a professor of political science at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, and senior academic fellow at the Center for Vision and Values. He's authored over a dozen books, and A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and The Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism, and Dupes, How America's Adversaries Have Manipulated Progressives for a Century. He's just published The Devil in Karl Marx. Paul, great to have you here. Thank you.
Al, it's always great to be with you, and boy, another happy occasion, eh?
Well, this is so important, I think. Earlier generations of Catholics, I think, understood that, and maybe I'm idealizing the past here, but they had a sense that there was an ongoing battle between the church and the world, the church representing the kingdom of Jesus Christ, and the world always trying to invent its own kingdom with its own set of rules, with its own vision. And when I was growing up as a boy, of course, communism, the Cold War was, you know, red hot. And so I grew up knowing that there was this battle between in history between good and evil. Didn't mean I was very smart about it, but I just, you know, it was one of those things you knew about as a kid. Let's talk about this. Karl Marx is one of the three or four most influential figures in the history of modern Western civilization. You can talk about Darwin if you'd like. You can talk about Nietzsche. But Karl Marx really might be number one.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Let's talk about who he was. When did he live?
Well, so he was born May 5th, 1818, and he was born, Al, in the city of Trier, Germany. And Trier is spelled like Trier, T-R-I-E-R. And this, I think, is really ironic and kind of chilling. The man was born in the shadow of the great cathedral in Trier. This is one of the most Catholic cities in all of Germany. Really, in all of Europe. And it was the great cathedral there goes back to the 330. Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, was there. They hold to this day what they believe. And by the way, Marx and his wife both mocked this. They made fun of it. Marx even has one of his devilish characters in one of his plays and poems put this on. They have what they believe is the holy robe of Christ that Christ wore on the way to the crucifixion that the Roman soldiers cast lots for, and that was brought to the cathedral by none other than Saint Helena, the mother of Constantine, who made her famous trip to the Holy Land, where she also believes she brought back the crown of thorns, which is in Notre Dame. So Marx grew up, of all things, in the shadow of that cathedral, and it kind of eerily presages when he's writing the Communist Manifesto in Brussels, Belgium. He's doing so in an apartment house that he and his wife rented in the shadow of the cathedral of Michael the Archangel, of all things.
Wow.
That's 1846, 1846, 1847. But he was from a family of religious Jews. They were fairly orthodox rabbis. The father converted to Christianity. The father's name was Heinrich, and he's the one, I quote him in the book, asking Marx in a really shocking letter from 1837. He's asking his son if his heart is governed by a demon, of all things. And that's
wow.
a typical thing that a dad asks his son.
did he mean that in a supernatural or a preternaturalist way, or is that metaphorical?
Well, it's a good question. And I mean, it's the kind of thing with Marx and so much of this when he's writing about the devil, when he's talking about Mephistopheles, when he's quoting this, and it's hard to say. But the actual quote from the dad is this. It's March 2nd, 1837 letter. "And Carl, since that heart of yours is obviously animated and governed by a demon not granted to all men, is that demon heavenly or is it Faustian?"
Mm.
And it's a really dark letter.
I was going to say.
Marx's response, is even more ominous. And then the father's response to that is this: just oozes bile out of the. You could tell here. In fact, Marx ends up not attending his father's funeral, which didn't happen.
So
you talk about Marx and his family. That's shocking.
So the reference to Faust, or the Faustian reference there, is, again, whether it's preternatural or metaphorical here, his father's concerned that he may have made a pact with the devil.
Yeah, that's right. And
wow.
There are, I quote throughout the book, friends like Carl Heinzen, a friend of Marx, talking about Marx, quote, chanting the words from Faust. He was, quote, there is one imprisoned inside, as he puts it, and you know, trying in describing Marx. And Marx was especially fond of the line spoken by Mephistopheles in Goethe's Faust. And that line is, "Everything that exists deserves to perish." Everything that exists deserves to perish.
Wow.
Marx liked that. He could recite it. He loved Faust. Robert Payne, one of his biographers, said he could recite Faust with gusto. You know, he wanted to be the modern day Goethe. He wanted to write plays and poetry. kind of like Hitler's private passion was
being the artist, an architect,
an artist. Yeah, I mean, Marx, really, the Communist Manifesto is not an economic document. I mean, it is a statement of profound economic ignorance, right?
Right.
It's a philosophical treatise. But his father converted to Christianity, and some say that he did so as a Jewish man under the social pressures of that time in that town, which might have been true. It's hard to say with a lot of this historical research. But this is quite interesting, Al. You'll appreciate this. Whereas Marx's uncle, or would have been Marx's dad's brother, converted to Catholicism, like most Jewish converts did, his father converted to Lutheranism, which was a very odd choice. And Marx ended up being... So Marx was baptized 1823... He was around 5 years old. His father came into the faith around 1820. The mother held off on having the children baptized, so she was holding off on that. And Marx became a Christian, became Lutheran, and I talk about this as well. I found hardly anything on this. You have to really read what Marx wrote about Luther to see this. I'm surprised that so many historians have missed it. But Marx wrote positively about Luther. And he appreciated how Luther and what Marx envisioned as this dialectical march of history, right? He appreciated how Luther provided the crucial breakaway from the church,
mm-hmm.
and by the church no longer able magisterially to speak with the authority that it had. That breakaway by Luther, Marx believed, was utterly crucial to the eventual takedown and one defining one's own truths and morality and versions of truth. So he appreciated what Luther did, and I think that's something that is not appreciated by scholars.
So this So he's about a work of destruction. Everything that exists should deserves to perish. He's he takes a look. In his estimation, Luther was not a reformer. He was a destroyer because he shattered the Catholic Church's control over Europe. We're going to come back with Dr. Paul Kengor looking at the devil in Karl Marx.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Do you ever just feel off, but you don't know why? Maybe everything seems fine, but you just feel down or disconnected. Well, you're in luck, because I've got just the thing to help you get your mood back on track. A new study by Texas A&M found that making small changes, like reminding yourself to smile more, can actually have a significant impact on your overall mood. Researchers caution that they don't mean to suggest that a person can smile their way to happiness, especially if someone is dealing with serious emotional problems. But they say the study is important because it highlights just how much our emotions take their cue from things like body posture or facial expressions. So go ahead. Give yourself permission to smile. It might be just what the doctor ordered. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Why is the church always considered holy? The church is held to be holy because Jesus Christ, who alone with the Father and the Holy Spirit, is holy. He loved the church as his bride. The Catholic Catechism tells us he gave himself up for her so as to sanctify her and endow her with the gift of the Holy Spirit for God's glory. United with Christ, the church is sanctified by Christ. With him and through him, she becomes sanctifying. All the activities of the church are directed toward the sanctification of persons in Christ and the glorification of God. It is in the church that, by the grace of God, we acquire holiness. The church on earth already is endowed with real, though imperfect, sanctity. In her members, perfect holiness is yet to be acquired, though all members are called to perfect holiness. Charity is considered the soul of holiness. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
How can we have faith and be transformed by the gospel? What part can we play in recreating the world for God's good plan? Once we understand that the gospel is not merely good news, but explosive, life-changing news, our life will never be the same. In Father John Ricardo's new book, Rescued, The Unexpected and Extraordinary News of the Gospel, he helps us to see the world through the lenses of God, with a clear vision of the plot and the outcome of the story that we're living through. You can get Rescued and Father John's other great books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
We need EWTN Radio for the reason that Mother Angelica founded this entire enterprise. She always saw this as a spiritual growth network. It was to be an enterprise in media that reached people in all aspects of their life. She saw this as a holistic approach to reaching the whole person in the middle of the world and bringing them truth and life.
Raymond Arroyo thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria mutual funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. You can learn more about the Ave Maria mutual funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Paul Kengor, taking a look at the life and the extraordinary influence of Karl Marx. back in 1990, I don't remember quite what it was, but I was just had been on the air a short time. I had the opportunity to interview Richard Wurmbrand, the Lutheran pastor who had been imprisoned in Romania for so many years, and he had written a book dealing with Marx and Satan, or I don't recall exactly what it was, but
yeah, it was called Marx and Satan.
Yeah. Now I only bring that he did not have a lot to say. He was one of those men who, when he comes into a room, there's a certain gravity, you know, gravitas right. that attaches to him, and I can't remember it to this day because it's one of the most profound interviews. Well, I want to say the interview was profound. The encounter was profound. There was something about this guy. And he spoke from extraordinary experience. And he thought that, of course, Christianity and Marxism were absolutely incompatible. And mm-hmm. he brought it back to the fact that Karl Marx was engaged in a work of destruction. So you write here that you cannot separate Marxism, the ideology, from Marx, the man. Was his life chaotic, full of destruction? I mean, in other words, does his philosophy grow out of his heart, this chaotic heart?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, it's hard to find a better case of looking at somebody's personal, private life and seeing it extended into his public life.
Yeah.
And by the way, Richard Wurmbrand, you know, he spent 14 years getting tortured in communist prisons.
That's his famous book, and Tortured for Christ, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. He said all the biblical descriptions of hell and the pains of Dante's Inferno are nothing in comparison with the tortures in communist prisons. And he said that he saw communists whose faces shone with rapturous joy while they tortured me, yelling, "I am the devil, I am the devil." He said one torturer told him, he said, "I've lived all my life for this moment to express all the evil in my heart against
you."
Wow. Yeah, yeah. And he even said in his book, Tortured for Christ, he said that he can't even talk about what happened on Sundays in the prison of Petesti in Romania, where they actually had priests, religious prisoners, consecrate human excrement and urine and give it as Holy Communion to Christians in that form.
Oh.
And Christians crucified. I have a section in this book on called The Hell of Petesti, where I quote, Al, some of the stuff that's been declassified in Romania in the last like 10 or 20 years, accounts of the Petesti prison. They were doing black masses. I mean, they were doing everything. Well, everything you can imagine, stuff you can't imagine. If you were to make a movie about the prison of Petesti and what Wurmbrand went through, you couldn't even represent it. It would be too vulgar.
Yeah,
you'd have to rate it X. It's just horrible stuff. But yeah, he's right. And that book, Marx and Satan, Wurmbrand actually believes that Marx was possessed.
Literally,
and,
yeah, okay,
yeah, yeah, and I quote in this book Robert Payne, who wrote the definitive biography of Marx in 1968, one of several works on Marx. This guy Al, he was no right winger, he was no conservative, he was like a British man of letters, professor of literature, art, drama. His two Marx biographies were published by Simon and Schuster and New York University Press, and he said. That he said it did seem at times that Marx was cognizant of him doing the work of the devil, that he seemed to be possessed by the devil. And in this book, I say, look, I don't know if that's true or not. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to try to say whether or not this guy was possessed.
Right.
But the things that he wrote about the devil, that he said, the level of destruction – as you were saying, the idea of tearing things down, Goethe's Faust, everything that exists deserves to perish. Throughout the Communist Manifesto, there's lines like this, Al. Communism represents the most radical rupture in traditional relations. It abolishes the present state of things. I mean, imagine that, right? Abolishes the present state of things. Mm. Communists openly declare, this is Marx and Engels, that their ends can be attained only by the forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions. I mean, imagine that. Forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions. Communists everywhere support every revolutionary movement, this is the last paragraph of the manifesto, against the existing social and political order of things. So, I mean, that's what they were calling for. And they said, here's another direct quote. This is from the German Ideology that they wrote. The success of the cause, it is necessary that man himself should suffer a massive change. This must come through a revolution, a process of overthrowing the old filthy yoke and founding a new society only in revolution, right? Our generation, like the Jews that Moses led out of the wilderness, must conquer a new world. And then this, Al, we must perish in order to make room for the people who are fit for a new world, unquote. So communists, Al, they'd play the role of sacrificial savior to deliver this kind of new secular atheistic covenant for the new world. And to this day, when I see people today, you know, even in the statue movement, right, tearing these things down, and I had a family member who said, I don't get it. What are they doing? They're tearing down. I understood Confederate generals, but Union generals and Lincoln and Frederick Douglass and Columbus?
Frederick Douglass, yeah.
Yeah, why? What do they want to replace it with? And in a way, who knows what they want to replace it with? The answer is that they just want to tear it down.
That's right.
And you know, they'll worry about what replaces it later. But the goal right now is, to quote one of Marx's favorite words, abolish, abolition, right? Take it down and stand there amid the burning embers of the burnt-down house, hands in the air, triumphant. I did it. We did it. Now the new generation, a new world can begin.
So what? Because see, this is where I find it hard to hard to put together. So he destroys. What is his vision for what he'll build? Does he really have any vision?
Well, the Communist Manifesto. So it's a very utopian document, right? I mean, so he does in the end have this idea of this classless society, right? This workers' paradise, this proletariat that would take place, that would kind of rise up from the ashes. But in terms of a lot of specifics beyond that, and in fact, this is why any economist or any practical person or any business person, right? You read the Communist Manifesto, and you walk away from it just shaking your head saying, this can't work.
Yeah.
How do you do this?
And then right? what? Yeah. And
yeah,
then
and,
what?
Yeah, and then what? But it, for them, it was like a religion. Ronald Reagan said that religion of theirs, communism. Mm-hmm. I quote in the book Arthur Koestler, and you know he was one of the great ex-communists, and he wrote the classic book, Darkness at Noon,
right.
and he talked about his conversion. Now, this is his conversion to atheistic communism, right?
Yeah.
And he wrote, quote, to say that one had seen the light is a poor description of the mental rapture which only the convert knows. This is a convert to communism. The new light seems to pour from all directions across the skull. The whole universe falls into pattern like the stray pieces of a jigsaw puzzle assembled by magic at one stroke. There is now, through communism, an answer to every question. Doubts and conflicts are a matter of the tortured past. Nothing henceforth can disturb the convert's inner peace and serenity, except the occasional fear of losing faith again, losing thereby what alone makes life worth living, and falling back into the outer darkness. So these are atheists, right? These are guys who are supposed to call religion the opiate of the masses. But like Gorbachev said, they treated these documents like a set of canonical texts. You know, they would replace the Old and New Testament with and people don't know this. Marx and Engels' original draft for the Communist Manifesto, they called it the Communist Confession of Faith. Communist Confession of Faith. And Engels even wrote to Marx, he said, give a little more thought to the Communist Confession of Faith. I think we should maybe ditch the catechism form and simply call it Communist Manifesto. And Marx said, very good. No longer catechetical Communist Confession of Faith, Communist Manifesto. So they used this religious language,
Did the Catholic Church very quickly pick up on Marx's Communist Manifesto, or did it take a while for the ideas to filter down?
The Catholic Church picked up on it before anybody else, any other institution, and this is so profound, and I think I've told you this before, it's one of the things that brought me into the Catholic Church, Al, when I saw this documentary evidence. The Catholic Church wrote this down even before Marx and Engels published the Communist Manifesto.
Wow.
It was published in 1848, and if you read, I quoted at great length, Pope Pius IX's Qui Pluribus, published in 1846. So this was the first year of a 32-year pontificate. By the way, he'd then be replaced with Leo XIII, mm-hmm. who also wrote a number of documents scathing mm-hmm. against communism.
Yep.
And that document, 1846, it was like the Pope had a crystal ball. And and if ever you could make an argument that this is a Holy Spirit-led magisterium, you read that document from 1846, and you say to yourself, how did they know this?
Yeah.
Right? They're not just that there'd be an attack on private property, but on marriage, family,
yeah.
on the clergy, predicting death, that they would bind their captives in secret and then murder them, quote unquote. This is the work of wolves in sheep's clothing. It's amazing that the church knew this. It's really, really profound.
Hold it there, Paul, if you will. We're going to come back, and I want to talk about infiltration. I know many Catholics wonder about the testimony of Bella Dodd, and we also know that in left-leaning Protestant circles, communism was attractive. So, infiltration next.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Maybe you've been hearing a lot about the need to make a spiritual communion while participating from home in a live-streamed or broadcast Mass. Maybe you've even prayed the prayer of spiritual communion. Spiritual communion is a concept that goes all the way back to the 4th century. It flourished in the Eastern Church and gradually moved west. Spiritual communion stresses the transcendence of God, where we unite our desires, intentions, and loves with the holy sacrifice of the Mass and the consecration of the Eucharist at the altar. Jesus, I embrace you and unite myself wholly to you.
The EWTN home video highlight for February is Lourdes with the Franciscan Missionaries of the Eternal Word. Go on pilgrimage with Father Joseph Mary Wolfe and Father John Paul Mary Zeller to the healing waters of Lourdes, where St. Bernadette first encountered Our Lady and where all are now called to conversion. Order your DVD set at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
There are lots of great ways to connect with us at AveMariaRadio.net, like our poll of the week. This week we want to know, what are some things that you are doing for Lent? Let us know now at AveMariaRadio.net and stay tuned to Ave Maria Radio to hear our results for the poll of the week.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Now, when Jesus was on earth, he taught us a great lesson. He taught us that he came for the sinner, not the virtuous. He came for you because you are imperfect, because sin comes easy to you, and sometimes you don't have the willpower to say no. But you see, if you understood the awesomeness of God and all his power and all his wonder, and he comes down to our level. He wanted to feel. How do you feel? I don't know anybody that loves anyone that much. And this imperfect being that's you and me and all of us, he did it for us. That's why you should never despair, because you're imperfect.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
I would always hear from different people at non-Catholic churches that Catholics were going to hell, or that they really didn't know who the Lord was. The Catholic Church is not all what people say it is. I mean, it's completely different. There's so many stereotypes. It's very possible to know the Lord, and it's very possible to have a relationship with God in the Catholic Church. I believe I was born into the Catholic Church, and that's where I belong.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Catholics and the U.S. bishops adjusting to a new administration and the obstacles to the Church's mission of religious liberty in communist China. To learn more about these issues affecting the Church and our faith, keep listening to EWTN Radio and the Ave Maria Radio app.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Dr. Paul Kengor, my guest. He has just published The Devil in Karl Marx. We have it available, of course, in the online bookstore. We are taking a look at what has been probably the various Marxist ideologies, whether you're looking at China with Mao Zedong, or if you're looking in the former Soviet Union with Lenin and Stalin, and leading up to its final collapse in 1989, you see Marxist teaching crystallized into national policies. And we know that 60 million dead in the Chinese experiment, at least 20 million in the Soviet experiment. Marxism has turned into being a death-dealing machine. And because it is a powerful ideology, it moves out into the world to make converts. And it seeks to make converts of teachers and of religious figures. It wants to influence the world. Who was most responsible for trying to influence Christians in the United States, both Catholic and Protestant? Who was most responsible for that? Who had the, do we know who had that as a job?
Yeah, well, there were a number of different people, and several sources, Al, testified before Congress on this under sworn oath. Bella Dodd, we'll spend most of our time on her, but also Louis Boudens, who's, this is great, his name was still on the masthead of the Daily Worker after Fulton Sheen brought him into the church.
Oh, that's funny.
You talk about one of the all-time great conversions. Louis Boudens, Ben Gitlow, who's the highest-ranking member of the Communist Party USA ever to leave and testify before Congress, Manning Johnson, and they all testified to the Communist Party USA wanting to, quote, obliterate all religion, unquote, but also to infiltrate the churches. And Gitlow, Manning Johnson, and most of the others, they talked at great length about the enormous penetration that communists had with the mainline denominations, and in particular the Episcopal Church, the United Methodist Church, and also the Presbyterian Church, what would basically be called Presbyterian Church USA, which is what you and I were both in at one point. And this is a quote from Earl Browder, who was General Secretary of Communist Party USA, speaking at Union Theological Seminary, which, as you know, Al, is very left-leaning, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, this is February 1935, and he told them candidly, "You may be interested in knowing that we have preachers, preachers active in churches who are members of the Communist Party." So as hard as it is to believe, they actually had not just preachers who were sympathetic and duped, but some who were actual party members. Wow. And this would include people like the Reverend Harry Ward, who ran the Methodist Federation for Social Action, what today we'd basically call social justice. And Manning Johnson and some of the others said, look, he was the Red Dean of the clergy. He was a private party member. You know, this guy wasn't a real minister.
I was going to ask, could you be that influential within those leftist circles and be a believer in God? I mean,
sadly, yes.
Wow.
and that's what Manning Johnson, Bella Dodd, all of them marveled to Congress. They said, you know, the one thing I can't get over is how 1% of us or a handful of us, you know, through deception, manipulation, could just hoodwink thousands of people. Yeah. It's really kind of a sad statement on the human condition. Now, some of them, to be fair, Bishop Montgomery Brown is one of them, and he was Episcopal bishop. Some of these guys got excommunicated. I mean, they got thrown out for heresy. But it was usually because of, and this is what you'd see in the Catholic Church too, right? Their politics could be as radical left as you could imagine, and they could get away with it. But when they started doing things like saying the divinity of Christ wasn't really divine,
right?
That's what would get them kicked out.
Yeah.
But in the politics, they could get pretty wild. They could get pretty crazy, and they really got away with it. It's astonishing.
Let's go to what you call the tantalizing case of Bella Dodd. So, who was Bella Dodd?
So she was born Isabella Maria Assumpta, this beautiful little Italian girl, immigrant, and she ends up becoming a communist at Columbia, like Thomas Merton did, like Whitaker Chambers did. And she ended up becoming one of the leading organizers for the party out of New York, and specifically on the teachers' front, organizing the teachers' unions. And she claims, and she said this to Congress, that at its peak, the teachers' union in the state of New York, she would have been doing this from 1936 to 1938, this is a direct quote, boasted 10,000 members, and in it, the Communist Party had a fraction of close to 1,000. Among them were Moscow-trained teachers and men and women who had attended the 6th World Congress of the Comintern, quote-unquote. So 1,000 out of 10,000, and yet that's an enormously high number. But keep in mind, too, that, and we now have FBI documents on this, Communist Party USA had, at its peak, never more than 100,000 members. But the FBI knew and had this documentation that half of all Communist Party members in the United States lived in the New York City area.
Huh. Okay.
So, yeah, it's astonishing.
Interesting.
And by the way, Fulton Sheen knew this.
Yes.
So for her to be able to organize 1,000 teachers just in New York State alone, when she had the apparent objective, which seems to indeed have been what she said, we don't have audio of her saying this, but we have testimony of witnesses, including Alice von Hildebrand, who heard her say this. So when the party came up with the idea of, okay, we've penetrated the Episcopal Church, the Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church, what we really need is Catholics. Mm-hmm. We just need a sliver, just 1%. That's all, just 1%. And they went to Bella because she organized. And she claims that she tried to place, quote, over 1,000 communist men, quote, unquote, in Catholic seminaries.
Yeah, that seems awfully high, but do we have any? I mean, we have a lot of detail regarding her work with teachers, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Do we have anything like that with seminarians?
Yeah, and the more that I looked at this, and you and I have talked about this a few times over the years, and so I really dug into this the last couple of years, and here's some hard data. In 1936, Al, there were 30,250 Catholic priests. in the United States. Now, that consisted of about 21,000 diocesan clergy, about 9,000 priests and religious orders. The number eventually reached about 60,000 priests in 1967. By the way, Al, the plunge after Vatican II is astonishing.
It is.
I had heard Catholics say this, but to see it in a handful of years is unbelievable.
Yep.
And in 1936, the year that she would have been doing this, there were 23,579 students in Catholic seminaries. So in 1936, 30,000 Catholic priests and about 23,000 students in seminaries. And that number would double by 1965. Mm-hmm. So looking at that, if they would have went to Bella and said, hey, think you could place you did a 1,000 teachers out of 10,000 in New York State alone. Do you think you could do 1,000 seminarians among, you know, 50-plus thousand priests and seminarians across the country? She probably would have said, oh, yeah, that's a cinch.
Yeah.
And besides, at that point, her and her comrades, they looked at religious people, to quote Lenin and Stalin and the others, as superstitious idiots and slack-jawed morons.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that'd be easy. You know, these people are complete fools. Of course I could place 1,000.
Yeah, but here's what I would expect. I would expect that we would have some testimonies from people who had, you know, had their own epiphany if they were communists within the Catholic Church. Some of them would have had some kind of conversion late in life, not that many people out there. Do we have any memoirs saying, I was a Catholic priest,
I was part of this conspiracy.
Yeah, yeah. Do we have anything like that?
I know. That is such an important point, and I think that's exactly right. That's the one thing really lacking, somebody to come forward and testify to the fact that they did this, that they were part of this. Now, I do quote in the book, I quote Fulton Sheen, I even quote Solanus Casey. I quote a number of different documents from people saying things like this. Not that they had been a communist and that they changed.
But they knew of infiltration.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They knew of infiltration. So it is something that seems feasible.
Yeah.
And let me put it this way: it's definitely something that they would have tried to do. And I have a chapter on what Earl Browder called the outstretched hand.
Yes, tell us a little bit about that. This is important. Yeah. Elaborate on that. The outstretched hand.
That was a united front strategy where 1934 and 1935, communists did an about-face and said, instead of publicly smearing religion, we need to have a different approach to Catholics in particular, and the religious generally. We need to quit denouncing it as the opiate of the masses. They figured, looking at numbers like, 180,000 Catholics in New York City alone between 110th Street and whatever, is that if we could get 1% of these guys, look what we'll do to our membership, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they started this olive branch approach. And this is where conservative Catholics listening to very carefully. I quote in the book the Catholic Worker, Dorothy Day's publication, writing out a beautiful editorial, firmly rejecting the outstretched hand and saying,
beautiful.
We know what you guys are up to. Even if we agree on reducing poverty and championing workers, we cannot be communists.
Right.
You have a materialistic view of the world. You hate religion. You are atheistic. It goes on and on. You know, America Magazine, which published an article called The Catholic Case for Communism in the summer of 2019, should read that article by Dorothy Day's Catholic Worker.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It would be extremely enlightening to them, apparently.
Yeah. It continues to amaze me that people do not take Karl Marx's own characterization of his work seriously, that somehow that we shouldn't take Lenin or Stalin's characterization of their work seriously because we know better, right? They made it clear that atheism was the beginning of communism. Communism grows out of atheism.
That's what Marx said. Marx said communism begins where atheism begins. Nikolai Bukharin, one of the early Bolsheviks, said a fight to the death must be declared upon religion. Take on religion at the tip of the bayonet. Quote, religion and communism are incompatible, both theoretically and practically. Communism is incompatible with a religious faith.
And, well, Paul, we got the music coming up on us. Great book. Really an extraordinary resource. And we just scratched the surface of it today. We'll talk again. We'll continue to, especially now with what's going on in America, I think it's important to get this out.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. Your search for affordable health care stops here. Since 2014, CMF Curo has provided Catholics with affordable health care sharing that goes beyond insurance. With programs that cost less than many COBRA and ACA-sponsored plans, CMF Curo is a Catholic health sharing experience that enables you to live fully alive while saving money. Call 1-833-GET-CURO to find affordable Catholic health care now. That's 1-833-GETCURO.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams. Contemplate the universe with me.
Before Abraham was, I am.
The omniscience of God is a mystery, but here's a clue. Physicists tell us that reality consists of many more dimensions than the four of space-time we live in. Imagine from God's perspective that in addition to the three dimensions of space, he also perceives three dimensions of time. Imagine that God observes time like we observe a three-dimensional table. Along the top of God's timetable are stretched the timelines of every one of your family and friends. At a glance, he sees everyone's birth, the events of their lives, how the timelines cross, and the moment of their death. Imagine that Jesus sees our time like we see space. Impossible? We really have no idea. But God knows, and one day you will too. At AveMariaRadio.net under Resources, explore the universe with me. I'm Dr. Stan Williams.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
Thanks so much. Good being with you over the last hour, and I'm looking forward to coming back tomorrow for another edition of this thing we call Cresta in the Afternoon. Let me remind you that all of our guests today, Mark Galley, Matt Smith, Paul Kengor, all have follow-up information available in the Cresta guest archives. So go to our website, avemariaradio.net, and take a look under programs, and what you'll do is you'll see Cresta in the Afternoon come up, hit it, and you'll see the guest archives there. Should be easy for you to find the books that we discussed. They'll be in the online bookstore. The articles we discussed will be in the guest archive. Contact information is there as well. So thanks again, and I look forward to being with you tomorrow for another edition of Cresta in the Afternoon.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's A-V-E-M-A-R-I-A, radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.